Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a special episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. However, today, Danny King and Nick Newman are nowhere to be found. I am talking to Daniel Mecca and Jordan Raup of the Film Stage. Gentlemen, say hello.
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 And you two just got back from Sundance, so since this is one of the most high-profile festivals that happens in America, and one that leads to a lot of good movies hitting our cinemas later on, we wanted to have a special episode so that we could talk about some of the best of the fest, maybe some of the most disappointing films, and everything in between. So that's about it. We're going to have a full episode later this weekend discussing 2 Days, One Night, the new Dardenne Brothers film. Before we get into that, which will be a completely separate episode, let's talk about Sundance. So, gentlemen, Sundance Film Festival. How was it this year?
It was good. Great weather. Yeah, this is our fifth year covering for the film stage. So
how would you place this one in the pantheon of years?
Ooh, how would we rank it?
I would honestly say almost every year there's been something that like could be in my top 10 in the year, and this year there I don't think there was.
Yeah, I would actually agree with you. We talked about this, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of interesting titles that are, you know, I would highly recommend, but just nothing like, I mean, last year was Boyhood, then there was Before Midnight, and no Linklater this year.
No Linklater films this year, so it's kind of...
I know, that's immediately, it's not a great
movie. But Linklater aside, I mean, even if you look at, you know, not maybe on me and Jordan's lists per se, but if you look at...
Like Whiplash,
this,
right?
Yeah, if you look at the Oscars this year and you go back to 2014 Sundance, you had Boyhood, which will probably win, right? And then Whiplash, which is nominated for like 5 things. So,
and there was nothing like Brian's favorite movie of last year, Listen to Me, Phil. Listen Up, Phil.
Listen to Me, Phil.
Sorry, there's a movie called Listen to Me, Marlon, which I will talk about later.
Because I saw that on Twitter and I was like, ah, flashback.
Listen movie.
And there was no Upstream Color or anything like that?
No, no Martha Marcy, right, Marlene.
Yeah, I was.
But a movie from the creators of Marcy Marcy.
Yeah, which I will talk about, which is great. Yeah.
But yeah, I followed on Twitter, and it just seemed like this year was very muted. There was nothing where people were flipping the hell out. So I'm glad that we'll have a chance to talk about it, because if the zeitgeist can't tell me what to watch, how am I to know? So <Zach. laughs> we're gonna do your top fives back and forth. I feel like anyone who's listened to the show before should be familiar with this format. Anyway, Jordan Raup, why don't you kick us off? What was your fifth favorite?
Yeah, I'm going to do a little cheat here.
Oh, God.
A little honorable mention, just because I think this film deserves to be mentioned, because it will certainly be the topic of conversation when it's released sometime this year by A24 Films, and it's called The Witch. It's one of the first films I saw at Sundance, and it's directed by Robert Eggers, who is a first-time filmmaker, but he's been a production designer and costume designer before, which you can see in the detail in this movie. And I would say this is the film that was visually the best out of all the films I've seen. And it's takes place in an old settlement in New England when Englanders were first coming over from the UK and settling. And it's about this family that. It's like a Puritan family that they do something that you're not sure what that gets them banished from their settlement. And so they have to go live by themselves and near a really treacherous forest. And a witch comes out, and it's not like a horror movie where it kind of builds up to the reveal of the witch. You see her in like the first 10 minutes, and it's like one of the most frightening things I've seen at Sundance this year. And it's just a great, they all speak in Old English, and that could seem annoying, but it's really gives it this authentic vibe. And yeah, and it's just a really visually awesome, you know, it's the direct, I would say, this is, gives you a hint. I would say it's probably the best directed film at Sundance, but it's not my favorite. So, yeah, so definitely be on the lookout for it. The thing that would just bring it down for me, it gets kind of repetitive in the second act. And in the end, it's just kind of a fun horror movie. It doesn't really reach any greater heights beyond that, but it's really well done. So look for that, The Witch.
Well, we all know that I'm in the pocket for A24 films. So
yeah, yeah.
Love you guys. I hope they listen to this podcast constantly. But anyway, so that's your honorable mention. What about one that actually made the list?
Okay. All right. I'll go to number 5. And you said that there wasn't something that was very buzzed about, but I would say this would be the one if we had to pick one. And it was Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And that got picked up by Fox Searchlight for a hefty amount of money. It was reported to be 12 million. People are saying it's now a little less, but even so, it's still one of the highest pickups at Sundance. And this is based on a book, and it's about, you know, if you just read the plot synopsis, it sounds kind of insufferable, like the typical Sundance movie where it's about a coming of age story and then with a kid, and then he meets a girl who, as the title can tell you, is dying. She gets diagnosed with leukemia. But I will say that it is kind of like, I mean, if you've seen 50/50, it kind of like balances humor with that very well. This kid is obsessed with classic and foreign films. He has a huge Criterion collection, and he recreates this film with his friend, you guessed it, Earl. And and it's just a really, really, really well-directed film. A lot of energy to it. This director, I think his name's Alejandro Gomez Rejon, and he really just brings a great sense of style to the movie. It's very funny. It will potentially make you cry. I heard a lot of reports where people were just like sobbing at the end. It didn't quite hit me that hard, but it is a very impressive second feature. It's strangely, it's the guy who made the Town That Dreaded Sundown remake, which came out and no one saw last year. So I'm kind of interested to go back to see if he elevated kind of what it sounds like a kind of a bad idea. But because his visual style here is great, he's known for doing a lot of American Horror Story episodes, which I haven't seen, but people kind of rave over that. Just the style, I guess.
Really?
People at Sundance were like, oh man, you've never seen his American Horror Story episode. I was like, no.
But, it must not have been Coven, because that was one of the most horribly directed television shows.
Maybe. I don't know which season it was on. I don't know. But but after you watch this movie, it will make you maybe want to go back and see if you missed something, because it's kind of like a Wes Anderson vibe, but not as like rigid, not as like storybooky as that. But just every camera movement, there's meaning behind it. And so really... an exciting number five for me. And Fox Searchlight's going to put that out, I would assume, in the summertime, if I had to guess.
Danny Mecca.
All right. So this, my number five, and there's a lot of movies that could kind of, like Jordan was saying, that could kind of fit into this slot, but this is definitely one of the more surprising and enjoyable movies I saw at the festival, was a movie called Sleeping With Other People, starring... Alison Brie of Community fame, and Jason Sudeikis, who, you know, SNL and We're the Millers and whatnot. And the movie is written and directed by Leslie Headland, who I believe was at Sundance 2 years ago or maybe 3 years ago with a film called Bachelorette, which kind of had a decent buzz and got picked up did pretty well on VOD, I think. Anyway, this is essentially... kind of very boldly her attempt at updating When Harry Met Sally. In the movie, it's very kind of obviously referencing that movie, from the plot to even the split screen device that When Harry Met Sally kind of used really well. And it works. It really does. I mean, it is a kind of a crude and rude update to that movie in mostly all the best ways. Jason Sudeikis is, you know, he's kind of always effortlessly charming, and he really... it's kind of in the wheelhouse here. He's doing great work. And Alison Brie is, I'm not a huge Community fan. I haven't watched every episode, but she really kind of shines as well. And their chemistry is amazing. It's kind of one of the worst parts of the movie. And this, I don't even know if this is a criticism, is their chemistry is so good. You're kind of like, why would it take so long for two people to not completely fall in love with each other? You know what I mean? And just and get it over with. So it's enjoyable to kind of watch them navigate their love lives. And I mean, the plot's very standard, and you know, it's almost not worth going into. You know, they're two people who they lose their virginity to each other in the beginning of the movie in college, and then they fall out of touch, and then they reconnect in New York City. And and it really is like New York City is its own character in this movie. But all jokes aside, me and Jordan were kind of laughing about this, because last Sundance, They Came Together was there and kind of totally subverted and made fun of the rom-com in a beautiful way. And it is funny that this year it does feel like Hedlund has returned to kind of re-energize the romantic comedy. So, yeah, I don't think it's gotten picked up yet, which seems kind of shocking to me because everybody seems to like this movie a lot. But when it does get picked up, I hope it does go to theaters, and I hope that many girlfriends and boyfriends and boyfriends and boyfriends and girlfriends all go and see the movie and enjoy it. So, and also it's got an amazing amazing supporting cast. Jason Mantzoukas finally has a big role in the movie. He's like the best friend, and he's like so funny. And
is he doing the Jason Mantzoukas thing, or is he?
Yeah, but no, I mean he's doing it, but and it works. I mean it's
you know, no, I love that guy.
Yeah,
I'll watch him in anything.
No, he's playing. No, he's, you know, he's doing the best friend who's like married and has a kid and hates his life, ha ha ha. But you know, really loves his life, and it works. It totally works. So
I love that guy.
He's great. He's great.
All right. Well, Jordan Rapp, what about yourself? What is your number four?
So number four, this was an interesting one. I walked out of this movie, wasn't sure what I thought. I think I originally would give it like a C+, and since the days have gone by, it's grown a lot in my mind. It is called Last Days in the Desert. It was one of the titles I was most intrigued by coming in. It's from Rodrigo Garcia, who last directed Albert Nobbs, which I was not a fan of. So, but this premise and kind of the people involved were too interesting to ignore. So it's Ewan McGregor. He plays Jesus and the devil, and it's in the last few days of his 40 days of wandering in the desert, trying to reconnect with God. And it's shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who has done Tree of Life, Gravity, Birdman. It's a very, you know, contemplative, meditative movie. The first 20 minutes are literally just shots of what the title says and just walking in the desert. And then he comes across a family and in kind of like a Noah fashion, where Darren Aronofsky kind of invented a parable to go along, you know, to expand from the small section of the Bible. That's what Garcia does here. And he meets a family of, played by Sirian Hines, Alette Zurer, and then Ty Sheridan, who was in two other Sundance movies. The devil tells him, if you can, the family is going through a lot of problems, and he said, if you can get this family to, you know, reconnect with each other, I will not, you know, torment you for the rest of your journey here. And it sounds like it could be kind of a hokey, silly movie, but Ewan McGregor just sells it really well. The conversations with him and the devil, you know, whether they're sitting along, you know, across the campfire or something like that, they're just really fascinating. Just pondering about, you know, what life means and stuff like that. And it's a really interesting movie. Emmanuel Lubezki, I would say, I mean, he does a good job here, but if you're looking for like a Tree of Life, like a lot of roving camera, beautiful stuff, you won't really find it. It's a lot of, it's a much more reserved style. The shots obviously look beautiful, but it's not that kind of, if you've seen any Malick collaboration, you know, it's not like that at all. And it has one of the best final shots I will probably see this year. That really puts the movie in a different context. It's just a really interesting movie. If a lot of people were falling asleep around me, and I can totally understand that, but it's one of those movies that, I think if it comes out, it hasn't got distributed yet, but I assume it will come out. I would definitely give it a try if you're at all interested and kind of before you quickly type a review like I did, just sit on it for a few days. Maybe
Jordan, you gave it a B-, right?
No, I gave it a B, but when I first got out, I would give it like a C+. But now it's like even getting up there, maybe B+ range. So,
it's the longevity. That's awesome.
Yeah. So after you see
it, 6 months when it's finally an A.
Exactly.
6 months from now, Jordan will be like, "This is the best movie of 2015."
No, I don't know about that. But after you see it, go in the desert and just just ponder just for 40 days, and you'll like it more.
I just have this image of this movie like just growing exponentially in your esteem. It's like 10 years later and you're just like destitute on the street, you divorced your wife, and all you can do is like mutter the title of this movie to yourself.
No.
Well, we walked out of the theater and Jordan just disappeared into the Park City snow and we were waiting for him for hours to watch. He came back and he loved it.
So I had to meditate, you know?
In a straight line. Yeah. All right. Dan,
all right, let me jump in here. All right, number four. This is a documentary, and I will say that every year I go to Sundance, I'm reminded how many amazing documentaries are at that festival. I mean, you know, it's funny. It's, you know, Sundance is a platform for so many kind of big indie movies, but at the same time, it is an amazing documentary film festival. So I kind of found myself, like all the other years, just, you know, surprised about how many great documentaries are there and how many I saw. And this is one of them. It's a film by, I'm going to mess up his name, but I believe it's Luis Cihoyos, and he's the director, and it's a film called Racing Extinction, which is a kind of a sequel of sorts to the film The Cove, which came out a few years ago and won the Oscar for Best Documentary. And that was about the murdering of dolphins in the Japanese region and just kind of this whole terrible market for dolphin meat. And, you know, it was kind of a very horrifying look at this one specific thing. And this movie, Racing Extinction, kind of jumps off that black corrupt market and kind of jumps into a macro look at the environment and our changing world that we're living in and what we're doing to affect it. And, you know, look, every year at Sundance, it seems like there is a movie like this, like Chasing Ice, or, you know, it's like a movie where, you know, hey, our planet's melting, this is really scary. So it's, you go into these movies with a little bit of, is this just going to be another one of those movies? Not that that's the worst thing, but, you know, you kind of go in a little skeptical. And I have to say, this is one of the most well-made, well-meaning, well-structured environmental docs that I've ever seen, which is to say it's very engaging. It's beautifully shot. Some of the most beautiful camera, you know, captured moments of nature I've seen in a very long time. And this guy, Cihoyos, he, the positivity in the movie, the focal point of the movie is the people like you and me, right? Who are like, I know the world is melting and I believe there's nothing I can do about it. So that kind of cynicism that comes with, like, we're all going to die, right? This movie is looking at you and saying, there is something you can do about it. It is bad, but we can make it better. And that type of positivity you don't see in every movie like this. You know, a lot of the times you walk out of these movies and you're just kind of like, oh, God, it's over. You know? And this one really goes out of its way to be like, no, it's not. You know, there are definitely those moments. But it builds and builds and builds and builds to kind of this big macro look at what we can do and what's happening. And Elon Musk makes a nice appearance and he talks about all of his cars and all of his, you know, plans for the future, and it all comes together really nicely. So I'm sure it'll be out. Jordan, it got bought, right?
I'm not sure if it did. I know, trailer came out, and usually that means.
I hope it goes to theaters, because I think this could be an overreach, but it can totally be a Inconvenient Truth type of a thing where it catches fire and a lot of people see it in theaters. So I do hope it gets a theatrical release, but we'll see.
So, all right.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Jordan Rep.
Yes. Yeah, so my next film, number three, like I mentioned, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene before, that's from a group of guys who kind of trade off directing and producing responsibilities. So now it's Josh Mond, who is, it's his turn to direct for the first time. Following Martha Marcy and Simon Killer, and After School, technically.
Yeah, Simon Killer.
Yeah, you like that? I forgot.
Yeah, I did. I think it's like one of those weird little films that everyone on the film stage liked, and we bring up randomly.
I pretty much forced you guys to watch it, so.
Well, I remember I had to interview Brady Corbett.
So, right. Yeah. So this movie, it's not kind of in that style where, very rigid camera that is, you know, this is much more of kind of like, I would even go as far as like a Cassavetes like thing where he's just letting the actors do what they want and the camera swallowing them. But anyways, the story is Christopher Abbott, who was actually briefly in Martha Marcy, and he was on Girls and he plays kind of an alcoholic. You get the sense in the first scene he's like in a club in the middle of the daytime, and he has headphones on while he's in a club dancing. He's kind of like detached from reality, and you then go to his apartment where he's living with his mother, and you realize his father just passed away, and the film charts a 5-month period where his mother, her cancer returns, and it sounds like the most depressing film of all time. And but I think Josh Mond really, you know, injects a lot of warmth and humanity to kind of a struggle like this. I think it's you know, their most empathetic film easily from this group of guys. And yeah, Cynthia Nixon from Sex and the City plays the mother, and it's just a really, really great portrait of a relationship between a son and a mother. And there's just such a heartbreaking like 15-minute scene towards the end of the film where they converse, and it's just so well done. So yeah, it's just a really good character drama. If you've gone through anything like this, I talked to someone who did, and they said they were just like a wreck after the movie. But I mean, we're all gonna lose our parents someday, and this is kind of hopefully no one has to go through exactly this, but it's kind of an authentic portrait of what it might be like. So yeah, it's definitely a tough movie to watch, but something I would really recommend.
I just, you know what I want from these guys next Sundance? I just want like a light rom-com. Just like a light, like, we're all gonna live forever, fuck it, you know.
Sleeping with forever, other people too.
That's what I want. And I want it to star like Chris Abbott, Brady Corbet, like all the dudes from these movies, and all like Louise Krauss, like all these like Sundance kids, and just anyway.
Just the happy-go-luckiest movie ever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a movie about like a guy who like loses his puppy but finds true love, and then the puppy comes back at the end anyway.
Exactly. No, he loses his puppy but like finds a puppy 5 minutes later and meets, you know, like Amanda Peet, and they just all get along.
I can see it.
Oh
my god. I say we write this movie and we give it to them.
Let's Sundance Labs this shit right now.
Sweet. All right,
let me move on to my third, which is another documentary.
Mother of God.
Wow.
Because, like I said, it's that kind of festival. It's called Call Me Lucky. And actually, it's one of, I believe, one of three comedy docs that were at the festival this year, at least three.
Yeah, definitely. There was a
National Lampoon doc, which got pretty good notices, just about the magazine and all that. And then
Tig.
Was there four? Oh yeah, Tig. Oh my gosh,
I forgot. And then Misery Loves Comedy.
Yeah, Kevin Pollak had a movie called Misery Loves Comedy, which was about just the idea of, you know, the comedian as, you know, you gotta laugh to stop from crying type thing. Mm-hmm. But so this is Call Me Lucky, and it's about it's directed by Bobcat Goldthwait, who we know from movies like Sleeping Dog Lies and
World's Greatest,
I guess,
Dad.
Yeah, biggest being World's Greatest Dad.
What was the movie where the guy's shooting everyone?
Oh, God Bless America.
God Bless America. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then Willow Creek is his newest. Well, would have been.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about Willow Creek. No, but he's, you know, I don't know. Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, he came up as a very popular comedian in the 80s, and, you know, he was in movies like Scrooge and whatnot. He's funny and, you know, Police Academy, but he really has reinvented himself as a kind of a great director, and this is one of his stronger films. The focus of the film is a stand-up comedian named Barry Crimmins, who was popular to a point in the 80s and early 90s, I believe, but then kind of fell out of favor. He was a very temperamental sort, and there's reasons for that. And this movie essentially digs deep into his life, personal and otherwise, and it is very funny, but then becomes very dramatic. And it's structured so that reveal kind of, you know, I guess it's a somewhat manipulative reveal from documentary standards, but it works. And yeah, I won't give it away really, just because it is kind of important to the way you watch the film. But it is a very powerful documentary, just about what's behind these jokes and this man. And, you know, there's a lot about the Catholic Church and his relationship with the church. And, you know, Crimmins is famously very anti-government, anti-structural Americana, you know what I mean, type of a thing. And just every piece of his life informs his opinions. And it's just a really interesting look at an artist. And not unlike Listen to Me, Marlon, which I know Jordan will talk about a little later. It's just an interesting piece of like what goes behind everything any of us creates. You know, there's a backlog of kind of trauma in one way or the other, and in this guy's case there's like a lot of trauma. But it's a fascinating movie, and I recommend anybody watch it. So
no distribution yet though,
No, just yeah. I don't think any of my movies have
follow the film.
So I'm gonna just talk about these.
Tease is what
I'm
you are.
Talk about these movies, and you'll never ever see them.
No. All right. Well, Jordan.
Yeah, number two. All right. So I feel a little dirty talking about a movie that already had distribution going to the festival and from Fox Searchlight, but
Boo.
I'm gonna do it. It's so good.
Sell out.
I know. So Mistress America is my number two. This is from Noah Baumbach, who directed Brian Rowan's favorite movie of 2013, Frances Ha.
God damn it.
Just kidding. That's not
we don't stop getting these twee-ass, fucking terrible Brooklyn-based...
No, Brian, I guarantee you'll enjoy this movie. I've enjoyed it much, much more than Frances Ha and much, much more than While We're Young, which is his latest movie, I guess. I don't know. This one doesn't have a release date yet, though, but this follows Lola Kirk, who was seen in Gone Girl. She's the sister of, I think it's Jemima Kirk from Girls. And she's fantastic in this movie. She plays a freshman college student who's just kind of like learning the ropes and trying to make friends. And it's not going so well. But when her mother gets engaged to a man, she meets her soon-to-be stepfather's daughter, if that makes sense. And that's that's Greta Gerwig. And Greta Gerwig plays this like overconfident, she's a rich girl, but she kind of doesn't know what to do with her life. I know that's shocking from a Noah Baumbach film, but but it's different.
The phrase doesn't know what to do with their life.
I know.
It's just basically tattooed on the back of his eyelids.
Let me just quickly jump in. I will say, I did not see this movie, and I know you're saying that Brian will enjoy it, though he didn't love Frances Ha,
yeah.
But your description of it would suggest not that at all.
Yeah, it's, no. But I'm already putting this on my wish-to-year list.
I will let you continue.
Well, Brian, I'll ask you this. Do you like 1930s screwball comedies?
Yeah.
Okay, you will enjoy this then.
I don't believe that Noah Baumbach is capable of making
lines. I know. I was shocked too, because I had no idea what this movie would contain. The second half pretty much takes place in one house, and it's kind of like, you know, there's like about 8 to 10 characters in one house, and it's really, really witty, enjoyable. It doesn't kind of, it's more about the comedy than it is about the characters. So that's why I think you might like it better than Frances Ha. It definitely has good characters, but it's really super fast paced, like a mile a minute. And so you can't hate anything for too long before it goes to the next joke. it's just a really, really enjoyable film that I think is his funniest film. By a good stretch. So yeah, I don't know what happened to Noah Baumbach, but I guess now being partners with Greta Gerwig has got a lighter side to him. Ugh. And there's no more Greenberg in his belt, but that's fine. Cause,
I was about to say, I really like Greenberg.
Yeah, it's not like that at all. These are characters. I mean, they do have Greta Gerwig's character kind of has a darker edge, but just the whole style is very much more just like a fast-paced comedy. But yeah, I was laughing pretty much the whole time, so highly recommended.
Well, that's okay. I also with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I assume it'll be a summer release as well.
He's in love now, guys. He's in love now. You know what I mean? It is what it is.
Is he like with Greta Gerwig?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that explains.
Yeah, everything. Dude. Come on. All right. Let me jump in here. This is actually not, I guess, not unlike in terms of tone from what I hear. Not unlike a Mistress America. This movie is called Unexpected, which has also not gotten picked up, I don't think, but we'll definitely get picked up. And it's starring Kobe Smulders and Anders Holm from Workaholics. And it is about Kobe Smulders is a inner city school teacher in Chicago, I believe, and she finds out she's pregnant in the first couple minutes of the movie, and her school that she works at is closing due to budget cuts, so she's got to look for a new job. And one of her kind of star students is graduating and looking to apply to colleges, but she also finds out she's pregnant. So kind of right off the bat, it feels obviously very convoluted, like, oh man, is this going to be kind of a sitcom-y oh, the older pregnant woman, and you know what I mean? Like, there's like a biracial element to it, you know what I mean? White teacher, black student, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and you're, there's definitely a worry of that type of independent film sheen to it. But it never happens. It totally subverts those kind of expectations of tweeness and kind of white savior structured films. And it just becomes this kind of wonderful little movie about motherhood and about kind of what, you know, as a woman, what you need to do to prepare for that moment of like, you know, am I going to keep working? Or in the case of this student, Jasmine, who's played by Gail Bean, who's wonderful in the movie, you know, do I go to college? How do I go to college? How do I support my kid? You know, she's coming from a family where she's raised by her grandmother and there are other, she's got brothers and sisters, but the parents aren't in the picture. So she's kind of a surrogate mother in her own way already. And yeah, I mean, there's not much more to say. It's just a beautifully structured movie. It's, I believe it's the third or fourth feature from Chris Swanberg, who's Joe Swanberg's wife. And it's one of the, I mean, it's as complex and as strong a film as anything that Swanberg himself has directed. So I definitely walked away from it kind of shocked about how much it kind of hit me and surprised me. And I definitely hope, you know, it's the type of small movie that would, I imagine, would excel on VOD, you know, with a name like Kobe Smulders, you know, that you recognize from TV and from the Marvel movies. I don't know if
we're recognizing her from the Marvel movies.
Yeah. Well, yeah. All right. Well,
don't get me wrong. I love Kobe Smulders, but
fair enough. Fair enough. No, not a strong role in the Marvel movies, but you know what I mean? I think there's enough recognition there that people, you know, for $5.99 are going to have a great experience. You know what I mean? Really enjoy this kind of, exploration of just kind of simpler things, you know, in your life that anyone can relate to. So yeah, I was really impressed by the movie.
All right. Jordan Rapp, number one.
Dun, dun, dun. Number one is a, wait for it, documentary.
Oh,
whoa,
shit.
Oh, yeah. Now, this movie is called Listen to Me, Marlon, as we've hinted at.
Listen up, Marlon.
Listen up, Marlon, directed by Alex Ross Perry.
Listen to me, Philip Marlon.
Yeah, this is Stephen Riley. I don't think he's made a movie in a while, but he's... this is a documentary. I mean, going in, I was like, okay, Marlon Brando, we like him. What is he going to tell us that's new?
Yeah, every single person at the festival felt that way, I think. Yeah. Literally everybody was like, oh, the Marlon Brando doc? All right.
Yeah, exactly. And like Showtime said, it's going to be on there soon. So you're like, all right, I maybe don't need to really cover this. But it's absolutely stunning. Probably one of the best documentaries, if not the best, about a figure like this that I've ever seen. It, I mean, it is an exception because it's hard to craft another movie like this because it uses the director went through around 200 to 300 hours of audio tapes that have never been heard before from Brando.
Holy
and
shit.
He created this incredible, I think, around 100 minutes. And you literally feel like you're in the mind of Brando for 100 minutes. And it's stunning. I mean, it like I said, we won't get in my review. I said we won't get another performance from him, but could potentially be better than what we would have ever gotten. It takes a fairly chronological look at his life. And it's not like a, you know, hagiography where it's just kind of praising him. It really goes to the dark kind of corners of his life with a tumultuous divorce and kind of the tragedy involving his children's futures. And it also just shows his love for acting and also like his feelings of inferiority. You know, he had an abusive father and it's just really stunning. I mean, it made me tear up. They use clips from Godfather and Last Tango in Paris to kind of dovetail in with his audio recordings talking about experiences in his own life. So obviously kind of the death scene from The Godfather correlates with when he talks about death, and it packs a punch. And it's, just thinking about the movie, I like cannot wait to see it again. It's just fantastic. So.
Yeah. And also, praise. I mean, you know, I got a chance to see it as well. And, this would be on my list as well, honestly, right in there with the four that I've mentioned so far. But, just to say another thing that's kind of very fascinating about the movie is Marlon Brando was relatively honest in his later years about his earlier years and some of his career choices. So it's not too surprising, but it's just as interesting and like funny to a degree listening to him also speak about just some of his roles that he just eminently regrets. And you know, and so that there's also a comedy too, where you have this artist who you could argue is, you know, the greatest actor we've ever had, you know, and it's interesting that this guy is, you know, tortured by some of these roles that, you know, you get clips of as well. And, you know, as someone who knows Brando relatively well, but not, I've not, obviously not seen all of his films, I walked away from it kind of like, oh my gosh, like, you know, art is so difficult and, you know, just kind of surviving and yeah, just that idea of even if you don't love Brando, or even if you've only seen The Godfather or something like that, you're going to go into this movie and take away from it something that's wholly separate from Brando, which is to say, living your life, getting old, watching your kids get old, watching them have their own problems, realizing there's nothing you can do about that because they're adults now. You know what I mean? All these things that are just brutal, you know, brutal and very true to anybody's life. So it really does a great job of kind of talking to the people who love Brando and talking to the people who could care less about him, so that anybody who would watch it is going to take something away. So,
yeah, totally.
All right. Sorry. All right.
All right. Damn. All right. Here we go. Number one. Jordan was saying there wasn't, for both of us, there wasn't a lot of movies that kind of jumped out at us as like, hey, this might be one of the best movies of the year in 11 months. And I will say, the more I think about this movie, the more I do love it, you know, outright. And that movie is called Tangerine, and it was directed by Sean Baker, who I believe was at the festival a few years back for a movie called Starlet, which was a similarly small scope movie that I believe was also set in LA. And so Tangerine kind of came into the festival with like a gimmick attached to it, and I feel like there's like one of these every year as well, which was that the whole movie was shot on iPhone 5S's, I believe.
Yeah.
And so you're like, you know, that stuff like that always kind of makes me a little like, you know, like any sort of Sundance trope. When you hear it, you're just like, okay, like who cares, kind of. And I will say, no one should care, because it kind of doesn't matter. I mean, there's definitely a digital aesthetic to the film, but it is just a great, kinetic, amazing, fast paced, in your face film. Kind of my quick tag of the film is to say it's like Crank with intelligence. You know, it's almost like it's like a drug infused looking, like tonally looking movie. Like Tangerine speaks to the color palette to a degree of this like LA set movie. And yeah, so I mean, the basic premise is we're following two transgender women who are prostitutes in a certain section of Los Angeles, and one of them has just gotten back into town after a 28-day stint in jail, and I believe that is Cindy, and then her friend Alexandra tells her at a donut time, which is kind of a you know, the center point of the whole movie is this donut time shop in the middle of this neighborhood in Los Angeles. Her friend Alexandra tells her that her pimp boyfriend has been cheating on her. And so the rest of the movie follows these two characters as Cindy searches for her boyfriend and for the girl that he was cheating on her with. And Alexandra is trying to promote this show she's going to be performing later that night. And then parallel to that, there's this Armenian cab driver named Razmik, who is just has a penchant for transgender women prostitutes, and he also has a family that's waiting for him because it's Christmas Eve, and he's got to get home for Christmas Eve dinner. And so there's a lot of stuff going on, and it definitely it's shoved in your face in the beginning, and there was definitely a point in the first few minutes where I was kind of like, oh, this is gonna wear me down, I don't really know if I'm gonna enjoy this movie. But I have to say, 25 minutes in, it won me over, and I just totally love these characters. And yeah, I mean, it moves like a bullet, and before you know it, it's over. It's less than 90 minutes, and it feels like, you know, it feels way less than that. And yeah, I don't really know what much else to say. It's just a beautiful movie. This one did get picked up by Magnolia, So that'll be available probably mostly on your computer, and that's fine. I think it's totally worthy of that type of of your MacBook, and it's super entertaining. And I actually got a chance to speak with Sean Baker, the director, and James Ransone, who is Chester the pimp, and Maya Taylor, who plays Alexandra. And yeah, it was great to talk to them and just kind of dig into the movie. And I'll put that interview up next week. So.
Nice. All right.
Yeah.
So those are the favorites. Are there any that we feel are going to be disappointing to people?
Yeah, I would say so. There's
there always are.
I'll give two on different sides of the coin. One is a highly praised I Can film that showed here, and then one's kind of just total crap.
Okay, so
I guess I'll do the Can one first. So a movie called White God, which I think it won a jury prize. I Can. Yeah, wasn't a big fan of this one. I think I did end up giving it like a C+, but kind of thinking about it, maybe it deserved less. It's kind of like the darkest version of Homeward Bound you could imagine. It comes out in March. Half of the movie takes place in the perspective of a dog as he's trying to reunite with his owner. And that element has kind of a cool factor in the first 10 minutes, just the way he films this and he actually sells it. But then it just gets in such brutal and bleak territory, like just, you know, dog torture and all this stuff. And you're like, why am I even watching this? It's not even, it doesn't, you know, tell you anything new about, you know, this is going to be horrible, you know, and it's not done in a particularly great way. And then the third half is absolutely just ridiculous and not in like a fun way. And yeah, and then the coming of age story and the other half of it is quite dull. So it was Hungary's Oscar entry and they didn't get in. So sorry.
Suck it, Hungary.
Hungary, yeah.
Sorry, Hungary.
So I wouldn't really recommend that, except other people have been loving it. So who knows? I don't, but yeah, it comes out in March. I would say avoid it. And then another movie, which I was hoping for the best, but I kind of knew it might have been bad, is the next movie from Napoleon Dynamite director Jared Hess.
God, why bother?
I know, it was the only, I had a ticket for the premiere. I was like, why not? It was one of my last films there. This is called Don Verdeen. It actually does have distribution. Lionsgate picked it up, and it's a story of this archaeologist, or I can't say
archaeologist.
Yeah, archaeologist. There it is.
Good lord.
When I think about this movie, it just wipes my brain clean. No.
We'll add that to the pantheon of weirdly pronounced things on this show.
Yeah, exactly. but Sam Rockwell is one of these people that you so eloquently said. And he works for this, he gets a job with this pastor who wants him to dig up like Christian artifacts. And I described it as like the lamest Indiana Jones remake ever made, because it's so deeply unfunny. Any laughs that do come, there's about I think 4 to 5 in the movie, they come just from, you know, not the script, just the performances, kind of the way they say things. So like Jermaine Clement has a few laughs, and Danny McBride has a few laughs, and Will Forte has maybe one laugh, and that's really about it. It just feels like a movie that was made in like the mid-90s and then no one saw it, but somehow Jared Hess is making it like 20 years later, and I would assume no one will see this either. So, but it is getting distribution, which is kind of shocking. So, yeah, just a very tired comedy that just says nothing new and yeah, just kind of a little bit unbearable. So,
all right,
it's my disappointment.
So see it, guys.
Check it out.
Yeah, do it.
All right, what am I talking about here? Oh, okay, couple ones. There's a terrible political movie called Zipper, starring Patrick Wilson, directed by Morris Stevens. That was bad, 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 bad. Don't see it. It's like the worst episode of House of Cards ever. It's like Elliot Spitzer story, but really bad. And there's a movie called Stockholm, Pennsylvania, which actually also starred Cynthia Nixon and Saoirse Ronan. And
I love her.
Great performances. Interesting idea. It's about a girl who is recovered after being kidnapped for 17 years. And kind of brainwashed and told the world was completely different than what it was, and has to kind of re-acclimate herself to the real world and her real parents. And obviously things don't go according to plan. And so fascinating to tell you that plot, and the first hour is great, and then it kind of goes off the rails. So unfortunately not really worth it. And then I guess the last thing I would say is The Stanford Prison Experiment was a movie that will get picked up if it hasn't already gotten picked up, and it is it's kind of similarly interesting topic, which is based on the real life Stanford Prison Experiment, which took place in 1971, where this guy, Dr. Philip Zimbardo, got these 24 college students and made 12 of them prison guards and 12 of them prisoners in a makeshift prison set up in like the Stanford hallways over the summer break. And it only lasted 6 days because shit got out of hand because, you know, the people who were the prison guards took their fake authority way too seriously, and the prisoners became victims because of it. And it is fascinating. It's directed by Kyle Patrick Alvarez, the guy who did COG a couple years ago. And there's a lot of young, great actors in it. And Billy Crudup plays Dr. Zimbardo, but it just kind of never... It never gets where it wants to go, and then gets super patronizing at the end, like over explaining kind of every little bit of it. So that was a disappointment for me, for sure. But yeah.
And there's a lot of like, I won't even get into them, but there's a lot of like, you know, good, not great movies that would certainly be talked about throughout the year, like Michael Fassbender's Slow West, The Overnight with Adam Scott and Jason Schwartzman, Dope, which actually is one of the first movies to get a release. It's coming out on June 12th. You can read our reviews of that, those movies. The Wolf Pack, an interesting documentary, stuff like that. So
yeah, I was gonna say we have a bunch of reviews on the site, so yeah. Make sure to
almost
check
50.
That out. Almost 50.
Yeah, kill it.
Like, do we have an exact number, or do we just know it's almost 50?
By the end of this weekend, it will be pretty much 50 films we've covered. Yeah.
Damn, son.
A few more reviews to go.
All right. We'll look forward to that. We will let you know as distribution comes, and we'll probably end up reviewing a couple of these on the show ourselves.
I was going to say also coming up, two great movies that were already premiered elsewhere, but you guys should definitely cover on this show. It Follows is a great horror thriller, and then Eden is, we talked about that at New York Film Festival wrap up, but two great movies that come out March and then May, respectively.
So. Yeah, I got a chance to see It Follows actually at Sundance because it did show a couple screenings, and that was a really, really solid film. So,
all right. Excellent. Well, gentlemen, thank you for coming to educate us about the awesome stuff that you were able to see at Sundance. We are all looking forward to being able to see it when it hits the theaters and VOD platforms around us. Let's tell the people where y'all can be found. Jordan Raup.
Yeah, writing every day at thefilmstage.com and also on Twitter at JPRAUP.
And I am writing at the Film Stage, not every day, but I do love it. So whenever I do write for it, I love it. And
well, that's better than every day because you're doing what you love.
I'm editing at the Film Stage every day. Okay, you can follow me at Twitter at DJ MECCA.
DJ Mecca.
That's it.
All right. And of course, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And remember to check out your iTunes feed or your podcast app or whatever, because there will be another full episode coming out soon in which we will talk about the Dardenne Brothers, 2 Days, One Night, which has garnered Marion Cotillard an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. So we'll see if that was well earned. Until then, thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Listen next time.